You're welcome. Good to see you all in the project. Now, as I've discussed, the main objective of the bill is to provide for an administrative enforcement framework that seeks to enhance the supervision of and the compliance with the Financial Inclusion Centre Act. This is necessary in order to promote the regulatory efficiency by enabling strong corrective measures to remedy the present risk. One of the concepts in financial regulation is to enable strong corrective measures. Now, regulators need to be able to take remedial steps as and when the risk arises. Now, it's necessary to also state that in prudential regulation, you don't wait for the risk to occur, but you have to be able to ensure that the risk management framework of the supervisor is done constantly, and you need to make sure that you've got constant supervisors who will make sure that there are preventative measures at the level of the institution to support to prevent this risk. Now, the need for the scope of corrective measures does not exist in the current legislation, so part one of the proposals here is to create that and just be consistent with other prudential regulations. This also follows a precedent. There was a precedent which this committee engaged us on in relation to the Security Services Act, which was introduced in 2007 under the Pension Fund Act. We also seek to ensure consistency with international standards for regulation, supervision and compliance with anti-money laundering and counter-terrorist financing. There's also just a limited number of other technical amendments that are proposed to enhance the legal Now, Chair, this is an international phenomenon. It's not just happening in South Africa. The Financial Action Task Force on Money Laundering also recommended after the emotional evaluation that South Africa should give appropriate and adequate responsibilities and powers to supervisory bodies to enforce the feature. Now, this they suggested that it be done through amending certain specific legislation, but we are of the opinion that in our context in South Africa, it is probably more appropriate to provide for this authority in SICA itself to ensure that there's consistency in the enforcement afforded to the supervisory bodies.
Chair, thank you very much. Chair, if I can pick up there and refer to the Financial Action Task Force, the FATF is known as the International Standard Setting Body, and it sets the criteria by which all countries will be measured in terms of their action against money laundering and terror financing. It's an extremely high standard, but certainly a standard that we as a country aspire to, as Mr. Mashiach was saying, and certainly we need to uphold. And FATF requires that we put in place a number of measures, of which the proposed amendments certainly meet those criteria. But, Chair, if you forgive me, I'd like to take the committee back to 2001. There were a couple of members who are present with us today who were there or in the committee at the time. But what were the reasons for the Financial Intelligence Centre Act being passed? Firstly, money laundering itself is a crime, and we need to accept that, we need to understand it. But more than that, what it also seeks to do, the Act seeks to do, and seeks to create a bulwark against, is the movement of proceeds of other crimes. Drug trafficking, fraud, tax evasion, proceeds from distribution of tips, etc. And the legislation seeks to cover all of those and to enable those, the proceeds derived from those criminal activities to be identified and for investigative action to take place. We know that criminals abuse the financial institutions to hide the proceeds and to move the proceeds. And they then reinvest those proceeds in further illegal activities. So what we're trying to do, or what the original Act passed by the committee and by Parliament in 2001 did, was to ensure that financial institutions were not made vulnerable, or criminals were prevented from abusing those institutions. And we need to ensure that institutions put in place measures that prevent this process to take place. Now, part of what the legislation did then was to create a legal framework, including give supervisors And while the strategy called for a legal framework which brings together law enforcement agencies, private sector and supervisors, we don't have the supervisory components in place. So we need to make improvements to the legislation in order to ensure that supervisory bodies have a chair. Taking you back, I'm trying to just put in context where the amendments come from. That's in essence. Now, if we go forward, then, and I've covered the issues here. We believe that the proper administration of the FIC Act will require that supervisory bodies are able to utilize measures and so on to ensure that compliance is fully in place. And to make the point, Chair, that this process of providing these measures has been the result of an extensive consultation process going back over the last 18 months or so. Now, the concerns, the difficulties that we've had, in a bit more detail. The Financial Intelligence Center Act only provides for enforcement of provisions through criminal sanctions. So any contravention of the Act constitutes an offense, a criminal offense. But we know that enforcement through criminal sanctions is lengthy. It's a complex process. And we know that criminal sanctions alone are inappropriate for measures that are, in fact, regulatory. Very often, it's a small issue that needs to be addressed, and remedial action needs to be taken by an institution. It doesn't need to be charged in the court of law. We believe strongly that criminal sanctions in respect of certain contraventions are very important. But an administrative process, Chair, we believe will prevent additional pressure being put on the formal justice system and provide a more flexible and efficient manner to address regulatory contraventions that occur. We, through the years of implementation, especially in the last 2 to 3 years, since the system has come of age, there are certain provisions which are absent. And the effect is to start having a negative effect on the ability to develop the anti-money laundering terror financing regime as a whole. And the key area we're seeing at this point in time is that of compliance enforcement. So what the bill seeks to do is to establish an administrative enforcement framework, which will then enhance supervision and enhance compliance as a consequence. Chair, the key features of the administrative enforcement framework, and as proposed in the bill, are firstly to clearly express the mandate of supervisory bodies to supervise and enforce compliance with obligations. Secondly, to extend powers and functions of the center to enhance its supervision enforcement compliance aspect, but also to ensure there's a more coordinated, integrated manner in doing so with the supervisory body. It's also for the center to fulfill the responsibilities of a supervisory body in respect of persons not supervised or not regulated by a supervisory body. It says to plug that gap. The gaps that we've seen that exist. And thereby, then, to empower the center and the supervisory body to undertake inspections, issue directives, request information, impose administrative sanctions, and apply to the court for interdicts where appropriate. If we continue in that vein, Chair, furthermore, to ensure consistency in the enforcement powers afforded to supervisory bodies. There's an inconsistent approach at the moment, and we'll deal with those in a bit more detail later on. To enhance cooperation and sharing of information between the center and supervisory bodies and law enforcement agencies, and again, plugging the gaps there. very importantly, to create an appeal mechanism, which will then provide checks and balances in the system in respect of decisions made by the center or the supervisory body. And then finally, to provide that every accountable institution and reporting institution registers with the center, so that we understand the environment of accountable institutions out there, all of those who are or fall under the legislation. To quickly take you through the consultation process, the first documents were circulated for comment in November 2006, Chair, to all the supervisory bodies and all the representatives serving on the Money Laundering Advisory Council. This was then also placed on the Centre's website in January 2007. Comments were received on the consultation document. They were considered and were appropriate incorporated into the draft bill. Subsequent to that round of consultation, further comments were received from a number of institutions, for example, the Reserve Bank, Financial Services Board, SAS, Department of Justice, Constitutional Development, and the JSE Securities Exchange. And again, further amendments were made to the draft in order to take account of those. So, Chair, the consultation process has been a vigorous one, an extensive one. I must point out that a forum was held recently in Johannesburg where there was further discussion. An honourable member was present there. But this gives us a good background to how we get to do the presentation today. But in the process of some of these inputs, and we've seen it in some of the media statements in the last couple of days, there are a number of misconceptions which have been put forward and have confused some of the intents and some of the objectives. And I'm hoping Mr. Mashir will go through and identify what those are before we then work through a clause-by-clause presentation. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. Honourable Chair, there has been a consistency of theme that came out of the comments received. And I will go through them just quickly. But the first one was the perceived regulatory overlap between the centre and the supervisory bodies. I will explain what the issue is there. And then there were people who raised concerns about the position of the centre and the super regulator. Again, I will explain a little bit about that. And then there was a number of comments that raised the availability of funding and resources to be able to meet these, what they said as imposed supervisory bodies, obligations of the supervisory bodies. And then there were comments that sought to express concern on the inappropriateness of certain institutions being listed as supervisory bodies, and then the legality or the constitutionality of the administrative sanctions. Just go through them on a case-by-case basis. Just on the concern of the overlap between the center and the supervisory body, the process that we are seeking to establish, or the structure that we are seeking to establish, is only that the center may be able to exercise administrative enforcement powers afforded in this country only after requesting the supervisory body to act and the last phase to do so. So there is no additional obligation that is set there. It's only to request the supervisory body to be able to do certain supervisory functions. And when it is unable to do so, then the center will then be able to come in. So there's absolutely no duplication of powers there. On the comments of the center positioning itself as a super regulator, Chair, the financial intelligence center has been established to primarily combat anti-money laundering in South Africa and the terrorism financing. Now, we believe that the central point in respect of money laundering issues and as a result should be the one that supervises and forces compliance with the Financial Intelligence Center Act and facilitates effective supervision and enforcement by the supervisor body. Secondly, it is only necessary that we have a central and coordinated manner in which we monitor and give guidance to accountable institutions, supervisory bodies and other persons regarding the performance and compliance by them of their duties and obligations in terms of the seeker. Lastly, Chair, we believe that it's important to annually review the implementation of the Act and submit a report thereon to the Minister. As I've mentioned earlier, there's also been some comments on the fact that the funding, the availability of the funding and the resources to meet the obligations may be a problem on the supervisory bodies.
move in order to enhance the fighting of the anti-money laundering activities. We have also sought to enhance this by creating a number of measures and tools for supervisory bodies that they may utilize to effectively enforce compliance with this act, with this bill, in addition to tools and measures afforded to them in the earlier establishment. Chair, as I've mentioned earlier, there's also been comments on the availability of the funding. You will notice as we go through clause by clause that we acknowledge, Chairperson, that there are issues of capacity here that will have to be dealt with first and foremost. But as in our engagement with the centre, we have agreed that the FIC will provide assistance for a number of supervisory bodies in respect of training and capacity building. And as we speak, the centre is preparing an implementation plan to facilitate a phased implementation of the bill. Secondly, Chair, the bill empowers the supervisory body to use any levy or charges it is authorized to impose or collect in accordance with other laws to defray expenditure that may have been incurred in performing its obligations under the FICA. There has also been concern around the inappropriateness of certain institutions being listed as supervisory bodies. This, we believe, Chair, is not a matter for the bill as a legislative authority to amend the schedules to the FICA has been delegated to the Minister. The Centre, undertaking the review of the schedules to ensure appropriate listing of the supervisory bodies is also necessary in this respect. On the issue of the legality and the constitutionality of administrative sanctions, these were also mooted, Honourable Chair, in 2007 under the Pension Fund Act. Now, this is not new. However, we have sought the counsel, the opinion of the senior counsel and that of the parliamentary advisers and of the Office of the State Law Advisers, who advise us that such administrative penalties are constitutional and legal. So we're moving forward on that basis. Chair, that's the end of our of the introduction to the bill. And if you will indulge us, we'll also request just Joanne to go through the clause by clause presentation.
Okay, perhaps before we go to the clause by clause, let's take questions. Is there any questions with regards to what you have just presented with regards to the rationale for the amendments and if members would like to ask questions with regards to that and also the consultation process. Are there any questions? If none, we will go into the bill itself. I must also indicate that the chairperson of the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence has refused to come and sit with me here on this joint sitting. And I think the political decision will have to be taken during the tea break. Are there any questions? Dr. George, Mr. Singh, Mr. Malota.
Thanks, Chair. It's just a question on the general consultation process. Is there a list of institutions or persons that are regulated or supervised in terms of this Act? I know it is very broad, but is there a list? And which of the proposed supervisors were consulted to ensure that they've got the powers to enforce compliance? Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Would you note the question?
Thank you very much, Chair, and thanks for the presentation. I know Mr. Mashia told us that there was wide consultation, and we're happy with the level of consultation. But reading through some of the press statements, and when you get such divergent views, I know you've tried to explain, give us your views, but when you get such divergent views, I mean, we know two lawyers will give you two opinions, and five will give you five opinions. I mean, that's their job. They're meant to do that. But why is there such a difference of opinion on principles, on fundamentals, rather than just on some of the issues?
Mr. Black.
Yeah, thank you, Chief. National Treasurer indicated that, I think it's slide 13, that the administrative enforcement are meant to enhance cooperation and sharing of information between central supervisory bodies and law enforcement agencies. And that they have picked up gaps that they want to close. I just want to be clarified, what are those gaps and how is this bill going to address those gaps? Chair, the last issue, just a broader issue on protection of confidential information. Maybe I should reserve it for when we deal with clause by clause. Let me reserve it when we deal. Let me just put that one question.
Thank you, Chair. Just a brief one. Again, if you look at that administrative enforcement, that to enhance the cooperation and the sharing of information between the centre and the supervisory bodies and the law enforcement agencies, what is the relationship between the centre and the others? So in other words, doesn't that give the impression of the supervisory body? Because certainly there must be a specific relation and for you to be able to act or to enforce that. So just, I don't know if you understand that question correctly.
Okay, I'll take the last two, but members must also not lose sight that when we had the Financial Intelligence Center appearing before the committee on its report, some of these issues were raised in the committee. On this part, and not to just, for us, just to lay the foundation as to whether this is given the same spirit in which this matter was raised when we met. Ms. Mokoto, a quick one, Mr. Mgoni.
Good morning. Thanks, Chair. I wanted to check on this one for accreditation of supervisory bodies. How will you ensure that those guys they are fit and proper? And then the other thing is the enforcement and compliance costs, because you'll be dealing with a multi-regulated area. So what are the, expected costs to that? Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Mgoni, I would urge that those questions that relate specifically to some of the issues that are covered in sections that are being amended are dealt with when we go and get to it. Mr. Mgoni and then Mr. Gwen.
Thanks, Chef. I just want to know on the sub bulletin. It's slide number 10, the last bullet. There's a sub bulletin that prevents pressure on the formal justice system. I just want to find out if you are saying it to prevent a single statement. Are there any, or do you intend to say steps as some of the steps that actually could be taken by the court of law, or do you intend to take the court of law in some instances?
Okay.
Thanks, Chair. Just for, just for clarity. I'm not sure whether this should be dealt with as you move with the bill, because it talks too much in general terms. You're closing the gap, global integration, the risk. Are we going to be informed of this risk and gap at that stage? Because it becomes very difficult as to follow what are we trying to do here if these things are not mentioned at point. I'm not sure whether that is mentioned specifically at that stage.
I think that links up with Mr. Blatter's question also. But if there are areas where answers are going to be found when we deal with the bill clause by clause, just say so, and we'll deal with them when we get there. Quick responses.
Can I ask Ms. Michelle just to go through a few of these?
Chair, let me start. There are a number of issues which I think we will need to take as part of the detailed presentation going forward. But coming back to some of the first questions then would be, which supervisory bodies is their list? That list was put up in right at the very beginning, the first slide. all of those supervisory bodies were consulted in the process. That then leads us to the second question for Honourable Member Singh, why the differences in principle, seemingly, in the media. That's not something I could answer. I think it's a matter of speculation and perspective and so on. I think what is clear, though, is the various supervisory bodies to which this applies do not have a problem with the legislation and what's being proposed here. So it's people outside of that particular loop who are raising concerns and issues. We have now a number of issues around questions around gaps, protection of confidential information, accreditation of supervisory bodies. If I could just come down to a question around the blockage on the justice system. We would anticipate that there would be large numbers of cases identified through various inspection processes by the supervisory bodies where there has been FICA non-compliance. Our estimation is that these would be, by and large, relatively small matters which should be dealt with administratively, should be dealt with as part of a remedial action on the side of the supervisor rather than charging the institution. It doesn't warrant that. But certainly we're in a discussion with SAPS at the moment to work out a process, benchmark, develop the criteria and procedures and so on for how we would then move from what is no longer administrative transgression, but actually a criminal transgression, and which would lead to a formal investigation and prosecution process. So that's something which we are working through at the moment to determine precisely the relationship between those two things. So, Ashia, can I hand over some of the?
I think some of the questions that came are interrelated, and I just want to take just 2 minutes just to explain what happens normally in the area of prudential regulation. When you, in the normal course of prudential regulation, what normally happens is that we would come before the committee and request that the committee approve certain sets of laws and regulations that sort of prohibit or avoid certain actions being done in the area of institutions that are being regulated. Now, it is necessary that in practice you then have two methods in which you do this. First of all, you identify certain risks, and I will use this example, the anti-money laundering as an example. You then say that there are certain transactions that you must report that could be suspicious to the FIC. But to do that, you have to have an effective risk management framework by which you can detect these potential suspicious transactions. But then you need to have a particular risk management framework, and we'll provide guidance on this risk management framework that you have to do. And then on the one hand, you then have to submit regular off-site reports. These could either be weekly or monthly or 6 monthly or yearly, whatever the case may be, on the one hand. On the other hand, you have to have on-site supervision to actually send inspectors to go into the institutions themselves to determine whether they do in fact have the risk management framework that you have asked for and whether they do in actual fact implement those risk management frameworks. Now, in many instances, these two go together. Now, the whole idea here is that you have to avoid a risk event from occurring in the first place. Currently, there's a weakness in the current legislation because it doesn't allow for that. You have to wait until the risk event occurs, or at least from the supervisory point of view, you can only act once the risk event occurs. And in instances of financial regulation, that will unfortunately be too late. So you have to avoid such from taking place. Now, you also, regulators worldwide have got the power to act as the risk process occurs, to be able to divert such action or to reprimand the directors of a particular company from continuing to do such a risk event or from threatening them with their licensing and so example, the register of banks does have these powers. So if there is a particular risk that may occur within the banking system, the register of banks would have the ability provided for him, sorry, the power provided for him in the regulations and in the Banks Act to be able to request the directors to abstain from doing certain activities or to force them to start doing certain activities. This is very important, Honorable Chair, because unless you do this kind of thing, you then wait for the risk event to occur, but when it does occur, it would unfortunately be too late to correct that process. And as it stands, you have to go through the court and do the criminal procedure to be able to have that corrective measure. In this instance, as a principle in financial regulation, you have to avoid such from happening because in financial sector, you have a risk of systemic contagion, which in other sectors it doesn't. Now, money laundering can easily happen through the financial sector. Now, the question is whether we should consider money laundering as part of the prudential framework. I would strongly argue that we do, so that the supervision framework is similar to that of the prudential regulators, that when there is a risk of anti-money laundering taking place, it can at least be prevented rather than be sanctioned right towards the end, because the outcomes of it can be dire in the consequences. Now, just going back to the question, Honorable Moloto asked about, Honorable Singh asked about why there are divergent views on this. Honorable Singh, the question here is to balance out the approach on the regulatory principles and the practice of regulatory principles and the legal arguments against the judicial fairness and so on. You know, I would like to introduce this, clarify this argument, similar one in the case of deposit insurance. For an example, when a bank has collapsed, the judicial manner of resolving it is that you have to go to the High Court and apply that you put it under curatorship and so on. In the case of deposit insurance, usually you actually have to sidestep that, because by the time you go to the court and the media follows this and they realize that there's a problem in all of this, by the time you finish with the court procedures, the bank would have been dead. The quality of the assets would have gone down. The liquidity would have gone down. It would be a mess. So in order to try and protect as much value as possible there, you do want to provide an exemption from the normal judicial system and say, instead of going through the normal judicial system, the High Court must at least allow the prudential regulator to be able to contain as much value as possible within that process and undertake a certain provision. So the whole argument is around the principle of protecting value in financial institutions to one of ensuring that it happens through the judicial system. Then Honorable Moloto asked about the information sharing gaps that may exist. It's important that we have an optimal sharing of information from the institutions that would be able to pick out potential risk occurrences. And this may happen not only in the financial sector, although it may happen largely in the financial sector. The risk can also happen in those industries where there are no regulators. For an example, in the case of the selling of second-hand cars, for an example, you don't have a particular regulator who would be able to get this information that you are able to get in the financial sector, either through off-site supervision or through on-site supervision, as I've explained. In those cases, you depend on the police to be able to do the investigations and pick out potential risks that may occur. Now, when they happen, you want them to be able to swiftly communicate such risks to the FIC or the financial sector if the proceeds of such activities would be deposited in the financial sector account. When you have this ease with which the information moves between the different bodies, it makes prevention quicker and much more efficient. Then Honorable Muller asked about the relationship between the center and other supervisory bodies. Honorable Muller, and Honorable Chair, I just want to say here that Honorable Mare. I would just like to say, and I think this comes out also from the argument of a super regulator and so on, I just think that there is a misunderstanding of the supervisory framework. Imagine for 1 second if the FIC were to extend its hand everywhere, in every area where such risks may occur. And there was a question as well about authority was to go in every area. Now, we've listed the list of supervisory bodies there. They would go to the FSB for an example. So, in essence, if we don't do it this way, in this kind of relationship where you request the FSB and you give them the mandate to be able and the guidance to say these are the sort of risks that you have to pick out. And if you do, let us know. Imagine they didn't do that, but they were to have an office in the FSB and they were to have an office in the register of banks, in the register of companies and so on. You would have a huge duplication where the FSB would have a certain office somewhere full of supervisors and inspectors of the FIC and so on. It would be inefficient. It would just be cost ineffective, largely. So currently, if you then allow just to extend the mandates of the existing supervisors in the financial sector, and you give them the guidance on how to pick this out, all they have to do is to be able to supervise them and pick them out the potential risks that may occur, and then deal with them at that point in time. If they are unable to do so for one or other reason, then the FIC may come in. We just believe that that is a better option rather than just to expand the FIC offices everywhere. In fact, our view is that that's exactly where you're going to have the super regulator. And in the debate around the super regulator, that's exactly where the conflicts of interest may arise. It's actually easier if the FSB just have anti-money laundering supervisors themselves and they're able to figure it out rather than to have FIC-paid supervisors in those areas, because that's where the conflict may occur. This argument would also come, I think, later on in other debates such as deposit insurance, whether you give deposit insurance on-site supervision powers or you enable the registrar to pick out these information and then relay them to the relevant supervisors. Just to remind you, Honorable Chair, in the debate we've had on the cooperative banks, there was a similar argument as well about whether you want the regulatory burden to be imposed on the cooperative banks from all sets of regulators all over the country. The consensus view at the time was that perhaps you want to have one central point of collection, which will make costs easier. It's in the same argument as we have here. Can I ask either Peter or Joanne to answer the question on how you determine the fit and proper requirements?
But is that not going to be covered in the clauses that deal with the government? Shouldn't we leave it for that? So those are the areas that are not going to deal with now, and again deal with them when we actually deal with the minister.
Chair, could I pick up an additional risk? I think Mr. Mashir has given us a very extensive and integrated view of how these things work, but there's an additional component which the Honourable Puella was asking, and that's the issue of global integration and risk. And that does have a profound effect, and that's an issue which we have to consider and take into account on a constant basis. Global integration. When this Act was passed by this committee in 2001, one of the issues that the committee took into consideration, Parliament took into consideration, that we were in the early days of a democratic transition, and we needed to ensure that our economy was able to integrate with the global economy, that financial transactions could take place easily, efficiently, between South Africa and the rest of the globe. But in order to do that, we needed to ensure that our institutions met with the standards that already existed elsewhere amongst leading countries. And therefore, part of what the FIC Act sought to do was to ensure that we were able to reach that threshold of standards. Those standards are expressed through an organization, the Financial Action Task Force, which we referred to earlier. And they set the standards for anti-money laundering and terror financing in a formula called the 40 plus 9, the 40 recommendations against money laundering, the 9 special recommendations against terror financing. And those are the standards that all countries are meant to meet. Now, part of what the FATF also does, and will be doing later this year, is monitoring the extent to which countries implement these standards. Have you catered for it in the legislation, or are there gaps? And certainly what we're trying to do here is to ensure that we plug the gaps in this particular area, but more importantly, have you implemented the legislation? Now, the concept consequence of non-implementation, and this comes back to the issue of risk then, the non-implementation, of not having either put the legislation in place or not implemented it, is that effectively you will get a bad mark against your name. A country that hasn't, hasn't done it will get a bad mark. That then feeds into the credit rating agencies. They'll look at the results of the assessment and determine whether that country is at risk or not for future investment by pension funds and others. So part of what we're doing is part of integrating with the global economy and meeting the standards is to ensure that we minimize risks for money laundering and terror financing, and thereby we also become a choice for investors to allocate funds and so on. So that's part of the overall process that we're managing through all of this. Thank you.
Okay, I would like us to move on so that we get on to the bill itself, if members are okay. Yeah, I mean, just to quote one example, in one of the media reports yesterday, one thing that came up was that one of the reports describes South Africa as a very vulnerable target for crime syndicate. It goes on to say that, to question the absence of reported money laundering prosecution, despite the fact that a high number of international crime groups operate in South Africa. So it's one of those things that I would imagine extremely desirable, but as to how we do it is another matter. Can we get on to the bill itself? John, are you going to do that?
Thank you, Chair. Coming to the
synopsis of the financial impact transfer which members have, but it will also be on the slide. Go on.
That's correct, yes, Chair. There is a document handed out, and there's a presentation summarizing that document. Will be on the definition section in the FIC Act. Most of these amendments are consequential to the amendments that are done in other parts of the the bill, and to bring the definitions in line with some of the new provisions that are inserted. One that I would highlight here is an issue that doesn't relate to the supervisory framework, but adaptation of an existing reporting requirement in the Act, which refers to reporting the transportation of cash across borders. And in line with international developments in this area, this concept of transportation of cash will be expanded to include other forms of monetary instruments that can be easily converted into cash, which are normally referred to as bearer negotiable instruments. And therefore, definition of that concept will also be inserted in the definition section. Then moving on to Clause 2 of the Act, this will be a new section that will be inserted in the FIC Act to deal with issues of interpretation and conflicts of interpretation between this Act and other pieces of legislation. This is particularly relevant to the context of the supervisory overlap discussions that we had this morning as well. It is so that there are a number of different statutes that play on the ability or the functions of or powers of supervisors to perform their functions, but none of them speak specifically to the issue of money laundering compliance supervision. And in order to achieve the objectives that Mr. Mishia referred to earlier, this section is inserted in the Act to say that as far as money laundering compliance is concerned, this is the Act that should be referred to. Clauses 3 and 4 expand the Centre's own objectives and functions, and this is consequential to some of the amendments that we will be talking to later on when we deal with the Centre's own ability to carry out inspections and interact with supervisors on a more or less equivalent basis. Then clauses 5 and 6, this is a relatively technical amendment. It's a change in the name of an existing structure that's provided for in the legislation, namely the Money Laundering Advisory Council. This has been an issue that's been around in discussions for a while now, that the name of the institution is actually misleading, which is the counter money laundering. Precisely. Clause 7 is also an amendment to an existing provision in the Act, which is a consequence of the introduction of the new provisions, especially on inspections. The current Act provides the FIC with the power to access the records that financial institutions and others have to keep in terms of this legislation, client records, transaction records, etc., but that must be done under authority of a warrant. And the purpose of that section has always been to assist the centre to carry out its analysis of the financial information that's reported to the centre with a view to passing that information on to law enforcement. So it's equivalent to the subpoena power that law enforcement agencies would have if they want to access those records. That should not be confused with the new inspection powers, which will be afforded to the centre and to other supervisors as well, where an inspection of an institution's records to ascertain compliance is not something that's done on the basis of warrant. It's not a criminal investigation and doesn't uncover criminal evidence that will be used in a court of law for which the due process of a warrant is required. But this power, that's the existing power in the FIC Act, is not aimed at achieving that objective. It's there to assist the criminal justice process and the centre's functions in that process. Therefore, we need to distinguish these two different processes from each other. Clauses 8 and 24 deal with the same issue that I referred to earlier of the conveyance of cash across borders and the reporting thereof. And this is the expansion of that reporting obligation to also include bearer negotiable instruments. Then clause 9 is a technical amendment to an existing provision in the Act. So currently, the centre has the power to intervene in transactions, actually instruct an institution to stop a transaction where there's suspicion of money laundering or proceeds of crime or terror financing involved. There's an exception to that power where transactions on the JSE Securities Exchange is concerned, because those transactions work on a assured settlement basis and therefore cannot be interfered with, cannot be stopped. It would have major repercussions for trade on the exchange. The technical amendment here is a correction to the reference of the legislation that in terms of which the JSE Securities Exchange operates. Clauses 10 and 11, this refers to the issue of disclosure of information, and I think it also touches on some of the questions that were asked previously. Currently, there are ample provisions in the legislation for the sharing of information by the FIC with law enforcement agencies or by the centre with supervisory bodies or by supervisory bodies with the centre. But the legislation doesn't talk about, so in all these instances, centre is the central point and sharing information with other institutions that are joined together in this framework. But what it doesn't talk to at the moment is the sharing of information between supervisors and law enforcement agencies, for instance, or between supervisors among themselves, where they pick up on issues that concern each other. And therefore, there's a need to expand, especially if supervisors will be focused more on compliance issues relating to money laundering compliance. They would be picking up issues that would actually relate to another supervisor's area of responsibility and would therefore have to interact. They might also pick up issues that are actually of a criminal nature that doesn't necessarily relate to compliance with the FIC Act, but where law enforcement agencies might be required to be involved in this process. Also that Mr. Michel referred to earlier of involving or establishing a process that will also involve investigating authorities and interaction and connection of the sharing of information with them. The issue of the protection of confidential information, I think, is very relevant when we talk about this. And the FIC Act has a number of provisions already built into it dealing with the confidentiality and the protection of the information, which would come to the centres or other supervisors' disposal in terms of the provisions of this legislation. There are offences of abusing that information. There are offences created in the legislation of disclosing that information, except for in terms of the provisions of this Act, in other words, remote to the implementation of the Act, the performance of a person's duties in terms of the Act, or in terms of the legal process where a court of law orders the disclosure of information. Outside of those areas, it would be an offence and a serious offence to disclose information that is uncovered or obtained through the provisions of this legislation. And the sharing of that information is strictly described in terms of the provisions of this Act. Clause 12 will insert a number of provisions in the legislation, firstly dealing with the issuing of directives by the centre or by supervisory bodies. And directives would have mainly two different purposes. On the one hand, it would be providing for an institution to take certain measures that are required to meet its obligations in terms of the Act. It's not creating obligations outside of the framework of the legislation, but certain steps that need to be taken so that an institution can meet its obligations. If those steps are not taken, by implication, the institution would actually be failing in complying with its larger obligation to identify clients, for instance, or to report information. If, for example, an institution doesn't have a proper system in place to record information that needs to be reported. At a different level, directives would also be used in the context of off-site supervision. In other words, where institutions would have to provide regular information to supervisors. I think Mr. Mishia also touched on this issue. So that supervisors can assess the internal processes, risk management processes, structures to identify risks, etc., within institutions and decide or base their decisions on follow-up action as a supervisor on that information that's made available to it from the institution. So regularly return, 6 monthly or quarterly or whatever the case may be, depending on how it supervises structures there and risk management system, would be dealt with in terms of a directive, for instance, to the institution. In addition, Clause 12 also inserts a new section in the Act that will be talking about or requiring registration of accountable institutions. This has been one of the issues that came up in a number of reports and discussions lately. The fact is that the FIC Act currently in Schedule 1 to the Act provides for a list of 19 categories of institutions that are all under the scope of the Act. But the Act doesn't actually name any of those institutions. It provides for categories of or types of business by description, and any institution that falls within that category or that description of any of the items in the Act by implication fall within the scope of the Act. The difficulty in supervising a system like that for supervisors, mainly but to some extent also for the FIC, is that you actually have to know who your clients are, so to speak. Who are the actual institutions that you are required or you would be requiring to submit information to you, for instance, for quarterly analysis, or who would be the institutions that you have regard as more risky than others because of the nature of the business, the type of transactions they engage in, the type of clients, or the geographic location of where they do business. So all those pieces of information need to be made available to supervisors, but supervisors must know who to get that from and where to find those institutions. And that's essentially what the registration system is aimed at providing. What this registration system will achieve is that an institution, by registering, will actually acknowledge and identify itself as an accountable institution. It's no requirement for carrying on business. It's not a licensing provision, or there's no approval involved in this. What is required is that the centre maintain a register more or less in the same fashion that the company's registration office keeps a register of all legal registered legal entities of companies and CCs and non-profit companies. So there's no approval required to carry on the business, but there is certain information that needs to be captured and recorded and maintained. In terms of this registration requirement. Clause 13 is actually the crux of the matter that talks to the role and the responsibility of supervisors. It amends Section 45, which is an existing section in the Act, existing section that currently provides that each supervisory body that's listed in the schedule, second schedule to the Act, is responsible for supervising compliance with this Act in respect of the institutions that fall under its jurisdiction. As Mr. Michel pointed out earlier, the problem with that specific wording in the current Act is that it doesn't give the supervisory body any specific powers that it can exercise in performing that responsibility. And it doesn't necessarily make clear that this is part of the mandate of that supervisory body. And in the implementation of this Act over the past few years, the problem that was identified around this area is that supervisors find it when they run into trouble accessing the funds on their budget to perform this function. It's uncertain whether it's part of their mandate or whether it's an ancillary function or an adjunct to what they should be doing. It also leaves supervisors open to legal challenges should they engage with institutions, for instance, to inspect their compliance or to sanction non-compliance. If it's not 100% sure in terms of the legal framework that this is part of their mandate, it's part of the mainstream day-to-day functions that they must carry out. So therefore, there's the need to amend this section and enhance the provisions that are there in the current Act to make it as clear as possible that this is part of the mandate of supervisors, that they are entitled and empowered to exercise, and that they would have certain powers that go along with that. Such as the power to conduct inspections. And the inspections would be the converse to off-site inspections. In other words, would be the on-site inspection or on-site supervision ability of supervisors. To impose conditions to qualify for license. In other words, should an institution, let's say, for example, a casino apply for a gambling license, the gambling supervisors would be in a position to impose certain conditions that would ensure that institution's compliance with the FIC Act, such as implementing a surveillance system, for instance. The supervisors would have those sort of discretions that would make it easier for them to monitor the compliance of the institutions and put the institutions in a better position to meet the obligations of the FIC Act. The issue of fit and proper tests, which came up in one of the questions, is also dealt with in this particular section. Supervisors would also have the authority or the power to consider a person's criminal background and the possible involvement or links with previous money laundering activity or terror financing activity as part of a fit and proper test. In other words, you wouldn't want a person with links to organized crime to be a director, managing director of a bank, for instance. And that sort of issue can be dealt with in terms of fit and proper test. Then moving on to section 14, which deals specifically with the centre's own ability to carry out inspections. As I said, inspections is a form of on-site supervision. These would be new clauses inserted in the Act, which would allow the centre to carry out similar functions to supervisory bodies. And as far as the issue of regulatory overgrowth is concerned, yeah, I think what needs to be pointed out is that this whole framework needs to operate on a system of collaboration between the institutions and the sharing of labour and the division of or allocation of resources where each institution has the best competitive advantage, so to speak. But what's provided for in the legislation itself is that there's empowering provisions for the centre and the supervisors to consult each other, come to an agreed position and move from that point forward in the implementation of that. What would happen in practice, though, is that between the centre and supervisors, memoranda of understanding or similar instruments would have to be reached. In some cases, those are already in place, in other cases, they are in the process of being developed. So those would provide for the instance where the centre would take responsibility or where supervisors would take responsibility. In the current framework of the Act, there are some institutions that do not fall under the supervision of any supervisor, where there is only the centre that is available to perform these functions. And this is likely this situation is likely to increase in future as additional sectors or industries come into the scope of this Act, which would have to be considered as the money laundering risk changes. Institutions that come to mind that might be included in the future are, for instance, dealers in high-value goods, which is something we do that needs to be considered. In all of those instances, if you want to call it, for want of a best term, a default supervisor or inspection power which has to be provided for, which would fall on the center's responsibility. In addition, clause 14 also inserts the section that deals with administrative sanctions that would be available to supervisors and to the center in relation to non-compliance with the FIC Act. And I think the point that needs to be made here is that these are in addition to existing sanction powers that supervisors might already have. So what this section achieves is that it creates a common baseline of sanction powers among supervisors. So all supervisors will at least have these powers, but some supervisors would have additional powers in terms of other legislation, which they would also be free to use in their discretion. The sanction powers that are provided for in this legislation are mainly a caution not to repeat a particular action or a reprimand or a directive to take remedial action. And I would hazard to guess is that this is the sanction that would probably be used most often, a directive to take remedial action. It could also include a restriction on or suspension of a certain type of business, especially where that business is identified as a particularly risky area of business or where there's no hope of meeting the obligations of in terms of the Act by providing a certain product through a certain delivery channel or something to that effect. And finally, a monetary penalty in respect of individuals of 10 million rand and in respect of legal persons, 50 million. And these would be maximum penalties. And it would be up to supervisors to take all the circumstances of a particular case into consideration when they decide on the appropriate sanction. There are also certain guidelines provided for in this section that supervisors would have to take into account. The point about these administrative sanction powers is that they are mostly suited to preventing the recurrence of a certain type of failure or a breach. And that's why I made a particular point about the directive to take corrective action, which is something that criminal sanction cannot achieve. Criminal sanction can only be a fine or imprisonment. And that cannot actually achieve the objective of an institution taking actions and making sure that a similar failure doesn't happen in the future. In other words, putting in place systems or appointing staff or something to that effect, which a criminal an administrative sanction can deal with much more specifically and efficiently. And therefore, this isn't an attempt to sidestep a legal process. This is an attempt to provide for a specific issue that cannot be reached or achieved by criminal penalties. Moving on with clause 14, will also insert new sections in the FIC Act that will deal with the appeal procedure. This could be the appeal procedure where an institution has been aggrieved by the action of a supervisor in terms of its functions under this Act. The appeal procedure would provide for an appeal board that would be appointed by the minister and would be headed by a person with substantial legal experience in this field, in the regulatory supervisory field. The center would be charged with the administrative and secretarial support to this appeal board, but the center will not be exercising control of the appeal board. It's an independent statutory entity that would be created in terms of this section under the or in the minute in accordance with the minister's discretion, and the center would be merely responsible for the administrative functioning of the office and appeal board. And the concept is that this appeal board would hear appeals from actions either from that originate from actions taken by the center or by any supervisory body in terms of this legislation. Clause 14 also introduces a section into the Act that would empower the center and supervisory bodies to apply to the courts for an interdict against an institution to take a specific action or to stop a particular action. And this is, I think, also very important, very relevant to the issue, the point that Mr. Mishia made earlier, to take corrective action as soon as possible, prevent the failures if possible before they actually happen. And this sort of power by the for the centre or supervisory body to intervene at an early stage through the court process, I think it's very important in that respect. Clauses 15 to 23 would introduce a range of offences as a consequence of these new provisions that will be inserted in the Act. Mainly offences that, for instance, deal with hampering or obstructing an inspector from carrying out his functions or not giving effect to the administrative sanctions imposed or giving effect to a directive issued by an institution or a supervisor, for instance. Then finally, clauses 25 and 26 are merely technical amendments to bring the index and the long title of the main act in line with these provisions as they will stand on it. Amendments are effected to the Act. Chair, I don't know if you want to pause there for questions or whether I should move into a few remarks on the Centre's speculation on the implementation of these provisions now.
Yeah, I'd like us to pause for tea before we take questions, and then I will allow you to move on to the Centre's implementation. Okay, let's break for tea for 10 minutes. We'll have to play the time back. We are going to first take questions, and then we will then allow your comments with regards to the implementation process. And, Mr. Mlotto's hand was up, Mr. Marais, Mr. Gwede, Dr. George, Ms. Fabs, in that order. Mr. Mlotto. My first question relates to not the B that but to a clause in the Act. I think it should be clause 40, I can't recall. You know, I just want to be clarified for the purpose
when
of our hearing.
Mr. Mlotto, when you say in the Act, you mean the Principal Act?
Yeah, the Principal Act.
The one that...
Yeah, I can't, but I can find...
2001.
Yeah, I'm just one... a bit of clarity for the purpose of our hearing, because, and for the purpose of members who were not there at that time when we processed this legislation, on the issues of protection of, I can't find the clause, but I'll look for it, on the protection of information held by attendees. As far as I recall, in 2001, we're saying that attendees have to report on their trust account, for example. Also, if Mr. Pablo Escobar or whoever comes with a bag full of money to pay for legal fees, I thought that was covered. I'm just saying, could you be able to clarify to us? Because I see, I'm not trying to refer to submissions, but it will help us, because when we do some of the submissions, that's going to be an issue that's going to be raised. People will be saying we are infringing on or we are invading into the issue of client and lawyer relationship. The other issue is on the sharing of information with other, which is my note I'm putting up, sorry. On sharing of information with supervisory bodies. And it's clause 11. You are saying the center may make available any information obtained by it during inspection to a department of an state supervisory body and other regulatory body.
But my concern is, how are you going to ensure that once the information lands with, let's say, with the department, that information is going to be held confidential? Because, you know, there's a new culture that's emerging in this country where you start to read a lot of details about information in the press. You know, how are you going to ensure? Because once we allow that, it's going to undermine this whole process. Because if I'm a banker, why should I give you information if tomorrow that information is going to be read in the press? I know the Centre has held the information confidential all the time and has done a good job. But I'm just worried when you start to talk about a department. For example, a department. My concern is, how are we sure? Are we sure that that information is not going to be used in a way that was not intended for in the bill? Chair, the last question, which has been clarified, but I'm just saying for the purpose of our hearing, we need to get some certainty or clarity on, is the issue of administrative sanctions and criminal sanctions. How do you draw the distinction between the two? For example, failure to keep a record, would that constitute a criminal offense, or is that an administrative offense? How then do you make that judgment call of making a distinction between the two? I agree. I mean, there are offenses that are minor, which obviously shouldn't be prosecuted for in court. But I just want to be clarified. How do you make a distinction between the two?
Mr. Mada.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, for me, I also want more clarity specifically on, again, the relationships. Clause 14 indicates that, you know, new provisions to enable the centre and supervisory bodies to appoint inspectors and to conduct inspections. I maybe failed to see and identify, you know, the specific relationship. In what cases will the centre appoint inspectors? In what cases will supervisory bodies do that? Must they, once they have identified something, must they then hand it over to the law enforcement agencies? What is the obligation on law enforcement agencies? Must they take action and report to the centre? Must the supervisory bodies report to the centre in terms of progress? And then also on supervisory bodies, who supervises the supervisory bodies? Because certainly, you know, just from what I see here, clearly there's room for supervisors to say, you know, I'm going to supervise you depending on how you're going to act, you know, towards me. So is there room for fraud, for you know, being nice to my pals and getting handbags and things like that?
Mr. Quetta. Thank you, Chair. I think mine would be more into what Honorable Lotta said, but maybe let me start that the good rating of South Africa, I think, is very important. All of us will agree to that and should work towards that. But we must do that against the backdrop that on the international front, there are also battles. Some countries, for instance, will treat any Muslim as a terrorist and then demand information on those people. So I think that's a question which we trust that the center will try and make sure that we're not used as pawns because we're not that at the center from we won't allow that type of cooperation in terms of, because I think this sharing of any information, because confidential information, there must be a need to know principle applied to it, because I'm just concerned about the sharing of any information, whether it's a department, whether it's a sister body, international, there must be really the information they need to know. I'm just concerned about this any, because they may use that any information as a method of just trying to dig information from South Africa, mining information from us. But just on that, other additional risk management mechanism in terms of keeping confidential information beyond betting? And for instance, to what extent does your center apply the policy of minimum information security standards? Because that's going to be important even to these supervisors, that the information you're getting is not going to be lying loose and getting into the wrong hands. I think that's what will be just concerned, just for us to move forward, that are there mechanisms, risk reduction mechanisms, to prevent that this information is not getting to people they're not supposed to get? Thank you.
If I can just clarify myself, between Mr. Mlodo and Mr. Gwede, the issue of information sharing that we're talking to is the Section 40 of the Principal Act, which is amended by 11 here, or 6A, or the intention of the new 6A. Are we all talking to that?
Okay. I found that the other reference I was talking about is Section 37 of the Principal Act, the one I was talking about on the common law right to legal professional privilege between attorney and attorney's client.
The information sharing one is 40.
Yeah.
Okay, the next one is Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair.
But you must also tell me if you think you have taken too many questions, because I would want you to be thorough in your responses. Would you want to respond to the three now and then we'll okay, let's do that. Dr. George, if you could just hold on to yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll deal firstly with this the question of the information, the protection and the confidentiality, and I'll also ask Mr. Michelle to give a bit more information on the centre's own internal structures and vetting processes and risk management processes. But just on the legal framework on this, as Mr. Malufta just pointed out, Section 37 protects the legal professional privilege, and that has been the principle from the outset when this legislation was passed. But the issue of onward confidentiality that was also raised, what happens with the information when the centre passes it on, that has also been an issue that has been with us right from the outset of this information, because the centre has been passing on information of a very confidential nature to law enforcement agencies to follow up through investigation. And it has been inherently part of the relationship building processes that we had to go through with law enforcement agencies to impress upon them what is the nature of this information that they are receiving from the centre and how that should be treated. And we must say we are very satisfied now with the level that law enforcement agencies have reached in understanding that the issue of the confidentiality of that information, and that we actually receive confidential information from a financial institution. And when we pass that information on to them, they must view it in the light as inheriting that confidential obligation that goes along with the information. And that implies that law enforcement agencies must still follow due process of law when they want access to that information. Even if we give them bank details in information that we pass on to them, if they want to access that information formally for evidence purposes, for instance, they still have to go through due process of law. They still have to subpoena the information and so on and so on. And the same would apply to the information that we would be receiving in terms of the inspection process or supervision process. In addition, the offence provisions in the Act itself that deals with the protection of information does not apply to the centre only. It applies to any person that receives information within the centre or receives information from the centre. And in the sharing of information provisions in this bill, there are certain qualifiers on how institutions must deal with the information that they will be receiving from the institution. But the protections that are built into this legislation already, in the current framework of the legislation, goes wider than just the centre and its staff. It applies to anybody that receives information. This has also been a point that we've made over and over in the discussions and the preparation with law enforcement agencies to deal with the information they will be receiving from us. They are actually under exactly the same liabilities as far as breaches are concerned as the centre or the centre staff are. I'll ask Mr. Michelle then just to talk a bit about the vetting of staff and the internal risk management of the centre.
thank you very much. Honorable Quelle asks about the vetting process and confidentiality of the information and classification of the information. All staff in the center are required to undergo vetting. That vetting is certified by the National Intelligence Agency, so we've got that in place. We have an internal classification process. We're introducing the MIST process at the moment, and again, it's through an engagement interaction with the NIA, who are assisting us in the process. Then there's a question of exchange with other international bodies, and there we are incredibly cautious. The legislation, the Primary Act, Principal Act, enables us to share information with other financial intelligence units under certain circumstances. And again, there's a series of criteria and processes and procedures that we have to go through before any information may be exchanged with them. And so we're very confident that we deal with that correctly and routinely. However, there are, on occasion, situations where we asked by, for example, international institutions to share information with them. By law, we may not do that. In terms of the FIC Act, we may not do that. And we draw a very clear line as to what we do share and what we cannot share. Of course, we can talk about the policies, we can talk about the legislation, we can talk about the environment which we are creating within the country. We may not and do not share information pertaining to individuals, individual bank accounts and so on, unless they meet those criteria that are established in law, and that's a very strong line. And then, on top of that, and to ensure this, we have a series of internal processes and procedures where even our staff, although they're all cleared, do not have access to that information either. So that yes, it's unfortunate, creates management difficulty because people work in silos, but at the same time, it's one of the ways in which we can manage and control what information moves where and how and so on. So just to give the member that assurance and explanation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think next I'll deal with the question of distinguishing between criminal and administrative sanctions. And I think the point to be made here is that the Act doesn't actually distinguish. It doesn't create administrative sanctions on the one side and criminal sanctions on the other side. The same action could be both. Where the distinction is drawn is which process is used to address a particular instance. And this would be determined by the circumstances of a particular case. Now, the example that was used, for instance, a failure to keep records. In 99% of the cases, that would be either due to a systems failure in an institution where they don't have a proper record-keeping system or they don't have a proper process to capture the information that will go into records that need to be kept, or they haven't appointed the appropriate staff to perform that function. All of those things are actually regulatory failures, which will be dealt with through administrative sanctions, and the proper administration would probably be to direct institutions to take the corrective action or to caution the institution not to repeat those failures. In certain instances, though, the failure to keep records might be part of a money laundering process. In other words, the person may actually be an accomplice in the money laundering process, and in executing the money laundering process would also not keep the necessary records. And in those cases, particularly, an administrative sanction isn't the appropriate response. There you want to institute a criminal sanction. But those things can't be laid down and cast in stone in legislation because it just depends very much on the circumstances of a case that would be incurred. A case in point is the recent prosecution, for instance, of a certain Mr. Graham Maddox, who was an accomplice in a major money laundering scheme which moved billions of rand. But his part of this scheme was to make available his professional services as an accountant to facilitate the movement of the money. And he was criminally convicted of the failures to keep records, the failures to identify clients, because he was actually an accomplice. Those failures were actually part and parcel of the money laundering service he provided to his accomplices. That sort of situation is not appropriate for administrative sanctions. So these are the sort of things that need to be dealt with in terms of guidelines, for instance, that need to be agreed to between the centre and supervisors to identify the certain situations where discussion with law enforcement authorities need to be had, and they need to be brought into a discussion process to decide what is the appropriate response to a particular failure. But But in 99% of the cases, I would hazard to guess, the nature of the contravention would not be one of complicity in a criminal activity such as money laundering. It would be internal failures in institutions that need to be corrected through administrative sanctions.
Charlie?
If I can just add to that, from a policy perspective, it's critical to have that discretion with the regulator or the supervisor or the FIC, depending on the nature of the transgression. And I think that's quite an important aspect that we would want to see retained in the legislation. Discretion must be there to respond appropriately depending on the nature of the crime or the contravention.
Okay. The next was Dr. George, followed by Ms. Fox and then Mr. Bengu. Joanne, are there outstanding questions that you're...
Yet again to answer Mr. Murray's question. Back to the relationship, I think I'll kick off on it and then just hand over to Peter on it. I think there's a number of instances in the legislation where we aim to create a relationship between the centre and supervisory bodies, and there's a specific provision calling for a memorandum of understanding in terms of how certain powers and functions will be performed. I think in terms of inspection specifically, the legislation is very clear. Both the centre and the supervisory body should have inspectors, and they can appoint them on an ad hoc basis and or have them permanently employed. So I don't think the appointment should be an issue. I think it's in terms of when the inspection happens and how it happens, and the legislation is very clear that the centre only acts in instances where a supervisor has failed after being requested by the centre to act or do an inspection, or if there is no supervisory body. So I think everywhere in the legislation, not necessarily only in respect of inspections, but in respect of all the other enforcement powers afforded to supervisors and the centre, we've tried to make that distinction as to when the centre acts and when the supervisory bodies act. But I think another important point for me is it's also, and it also comes out of the comments quite a lot, is that people sort of seem to distrust public institutions which we put in place through legislation. And there's always this fear that people will abuse their powers or act out of line. And I think it is important that legislation can never circumscribe the powers of a supervisor or the centre to such an extent that it will actually paralyse them in taking appropriate action. So I think there is always an element of trust. When Parliament passes legislation and entrusts specific institutions with powers, it's important to recognise that there is an element of trust. We need to assume that everybody will act reasonably. If a person or a supervisor centre does not act reasonably, the recourse to court is always there in terms of either reviewing the action or going on appeal against the decision or asking for an interdict or mandamus for the regulator or supervisor to act in a specific manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the only thing to add is that the division of labour and responsibility between the centre and supervisors is something that is primarily based on relationships between these institutions, which are in the process of being established. The centre has only been around for 4 or 5 years in this area, but over this period, the major focus of energy has been on establishing and cementing these relationships. These additional functions and powers will place added pressure on that process, which is why there's particular recognition in the legislation for memoranda of understanding, for instance, that need to be put in place to provide certainty to both the supervisor and the centre and the community that needs to function in this environment as to who will take action and when. And I think that is something that must be understood when one reads through the legislation. Legislation is empowering in nature. It doesn't determine the boundaries of the responsibilities or demarcate them between the various entities. That is something that needs to be agreed to between the different parties and who will allocate its resources and on what basis. I think the issue that was also raised in the questions that follows on from this is who then supervises the supervisors. It's certainly not the centre's role to supervise supervisors. And that will not be the position in terms of this legislation. It's not the intention of this legislation, and the centre will not assume that position. Or it cannot even legally assume that position. This was a question that was before this committee when the bill, the initial financial intelligence into bill went through Parliament as well. It's, supervisor's action, there is legal recourse that they need to take against that supervisor. But the supervisors are not accountable to each other or to the centre or to any government entity. And that's the nature of supervision. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Dr. Church.
Thank you, Chair. I was just wondering, it seems as if the role of the Counter-Money Laundering Advisory Council is limited to money laundering, while FICA also looks at terrorist financing, unless I'm missing something. And then the other question is, are provisions of the bill aligned with similar provisions of the General Financial Services Amendment Bill, if any? Thank you.
Ms. Fox.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, if we look at the slide, I think, relating to Clause 14, Clauses 13 and 14, as it were, and 14 in particular, refers to the new powers of inspection. If you look at the Principal Act itself, it indicates that when requiring records and insisting on this kind of inspection and so on, a warrant of some sort from a magistrate or judge would be required. When we come back here and we look at the new clause, you know, using computer systems per se, equipment on the premises, is not generally provided by that sort of warrant, etc. And I'm wondering just if we could get a clarification as to how, I've had a look at what at the phraseology within the amendments and so on, and it does look fairly broad. And in issuing, you know, in the warrants, et cetera, these are far more narrowly defined. So you don't just have, as it were, a shotgun approach to it. So if we could get some clarification on that particular one, Chairperson. The other one is with respect to Schedule 1. The amendment bill itself refers, among other things, to the fact that this is going to update, if you like, repealed legislation, new legislation, acts, and so on. And yet, in a number of instances, it does so in certain areas, broadly speaking, and yet it omits to include certain institutions that are currently contained under Schedule 1 itself. The question then is, will Schedule 1 currently come under review? It's not, this is not proposed now, and it does seem to be a conflict. And secondly, if you look at Schedule 1 and Schedule 2, when these are reviewed, will they include the Land Bank? Thank you.
Mr. Bengel.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chair. I think that, first of all, one must actually acknowledge the central requirement as explained by the Department of realigning our country's financial management to the requirements of the international standards. I think that was well, you know, captured and understood. And that actually, from a global perspective, is quite acceptable. I was going to ask, as one of my questions, the issue of the relationship between the center and the supervisory bodies. But that question has been sort of answered by a gentleman, I mean, when he talked about the whole issue of the division of labor and relationship between the center and the supervisors, that that process is being addressed by actually developing the whole scenario of that kind of relationship, because actually I didn't see it in some of the documents here that it is being addressed. My other question is the issue of the minister, I mean, according to the Principal Act. Chair, perhaps you will forgive some of us who are in this meeting for the first time.
one hasn't been able to go through all these documentations here. But it comes clear here that the minister is having quite a number of huge powers. You see that he would have to appoint the board, he would have to appoint the chairperson of the council, he would have to appoint the director of the center. And I wonder, how does this actually relate to one concern raised by another member, that of guarding against making the whole thing losing respect in the public. And I'm sure that perhaps the amendment of which hasn't gone through would actually try to address that, to minimize those kind of powers, because they're quite very huge as far as I'm concerned. My last one, Chair, is the whole issue of the internet banking. I see that Section 31 of the Principal Act actually is dealing with the electronic banking. I wonder if somewhere something could actually be said specifically how do we deal with the whole issue of the internet banking, because there is a lot of money laundering or money something of that nature happening within the whole scenario of internet banking.
Honourable Pages.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'm interested in the amendment, Clause 43B in the Amendment Act, which now requires for the registration of accounting institutions. I don't speak for the legal trade here or for the attorneys, Chair. I just see some security issues here that I think the department needs to look at. In terms of Section 1 of the Principal Act, accounting institutions, number one on the list, which is in the Schedule 1, are attorneys, as defined in the Attorneys Act. Now, it appears now that what is required in terms of the amendment are that that attorneys need to be registered. I'm just wondering whether it is the thinking now that each individual attorney be registered, because it's not going to be clear from the Schedule 1, which just defines an attorney as somebody defined in the Attorneys Act. Or are we talking now about attorneys, companies, because attorneys practice under different circumstances. They practice as an individual, they practice as partnerships, they practice as corporate bodies now. Is the thinking that only those corporate bodies that have the trust account obligation in terms of the law society, that they be registered? Or is it that each and every attorney be registered in terms of this amendment, in the Amendment Law 43B? I don't think it doesn't come out from this at the moment what is really intended. I think if every attorney is registered, Schedule, and is it going to be revised? And now to move into a different environment where you equally now can conduct. And I'm not saying that debt collectors are dishonest people, but they run trust accounts. And they do not have a supervisory body that monitors how their trust accounts work, such as an attorney who have a law society that has that looks for an audit every year and monitors how that auditing is done. Debt collectors don't have that. They have a council that supervises them, but it deals with registration and it deals with some disciplinary matters. It does not deal with the financial thing. And under the Debt Collectors Act, every debt collector has to be registered, but attorneys are exempted. So you have people out there, and there are thousands of them. I can't remember the amount, but it's an astronomical amount of debt collectors that they run trust accounts, and nobody worries about what goes on in their trust accounts. And I'm quite surprised that they haven't been included in Schedule 1 in the first place, because they don't have a supervisory body such as the Law Society that has a whole act that monitors how you behave and how you don't behave. So I'm just wondering if there, it's an area that I think criminals might consider moving into now, because there's an whole area there which you can use and abuse if you have debt collectors collecting fictitious debts for you and keeping the money in trust accounts and things like that. And I'm not suggesting that debt collectors are dishonest people, but I'm just saying they might not know who they are dealing with. And perhaps we can hear something from the department on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Singh.
Thank you very much, Chair. I just want to follow up on the honourable colleague there. Because you take, like, non-governmental organisations, NGOs and things like that. You know, I've heard over the years of people from the U.S. and other places coming up with millions of dollars for housing projects and things like that. And you begin to wonder, you know, what kind of money is this coming in here? Tens of millions of dollars that they offer organizations here to say, go and build houses and we'll do this and we'll charge you 2% and 3% interest. And I'm also, and without casting any aspersions like the colleague did on debt collectors, religious organizations. People could use them. So what kind of supervisory ability is going to be put in place for those types of organizations? But Chair, the question I was going to ask is on compliance and the administrative sanctions. Firstly, what informed the penalties, the amounts of the penalties? I know it says not exceeding, but something must have informed it. And then on slide, there's no number here, implementation of the Act, the training. You say your training will start in May 2009 and you're ready to commence from August 2009. Now, are you looking at implementation of the Act in 2009? And secondly, is 3 months sufficient for training? And does the center have the capacity, financial and human capacity, to deal with this kind of issue? And lastly, Chair, I know we're dealing with submissions tomorrow. But there are a number of issues I've just been reading through some of the submissions, as other colleagues would have been also reading through them. And what I'd like to know is from Mr. Mashiach and his team, to what extent have some of these submissions, which seem very legitimate and relevant to the amendment, been taken into consideration so far by the center and the drafters of the legislation? Have they been talking to each other or past each other? And I think that is a question that I'd like to ask.
Okay, let's take responses, but Mr. Singh, remember that we haven't taken a presentation on the implementation yet. But when they do it, they will respond to your question. But can we have a quick response? Why is Mario running away? Sabotages the electricity and he runs away. I can see that. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We'll divide the responses between myself and Mr. Herrera. I'll just briefly talk about the IMLAC amendment, but Mr. Herrera will also add on that. The issue of this legislation, the purpose of this legislation, is not to amend the scope or the functions or the powers of the IMLAC. It's to make a technical correction, which we were asked to do some time ago already. But I think it is true that this we already taking into review with a view to adapting the anti-money laundering framework that's provided for in this legislation. That will be a future process that will carry on for some time. But I'll also ask Mr. Rada just to talk about the detail on this and the general financial services maintenance bill.
I think, as Nkosana highlighted in the beginning of his presentation, there is a move to re-evaluate enforcement in respect of the whole financial sector per se. And I think last year we started with the Pension Funds Amendment Bill and the Banks Act Amendment Bill to sort of strengthen the powers and the enforcement capabilities of the regulators. And I think that sort of theme perpetuates in respect of the General Financial Services Laws Amendment Bill. It is a bit different than in respect of the other three bills, in the sense that we're creating an enforcement committee for the full bevy of legislation that the FSB administers. So there's an enforcement committee that will enforce matters referred to it by the registrars of pensions, long-term, short-term, capital markets, etc. And it's really in terms of facilitating a specific structure of the FSB per se. But in respect of appeals, in respect of administrative justice issues, in terms of information, administrative penalties, the considerations, etc., there is a aligned, a clear link between all the pieces of legislation. So we have aligned it to the greatest extent possible, taking into account the special nature of the regulators.
Chair, then I'll deal next with the question of inspections and warrants and access to electronically stored information. The Act currently provides that the centre may access information under power of a warrant. And the purpose for that provision is not to inspect institutions and to make use of that access to information from a regulatory oversight point of view. It's the access to information that will actually become part of a criminal investigation process. Therefore, the warrant provision that is on a par with the due process that a law enforcement agency would have to follow. That needs to be distinguished from the access to information in an on-site supervision scenario where an inspection isn't looking at the client's particulars that are held by an institution, but are looking at the compliance-related information that an institution holds. And that information is not accessed under the authority of a warrant. Even currently, where supervisors access on-site inspection information, they do not require warrants to go through that process. And the same principle would apply in the case of the inspection powers that would be provided for here. The inspection provisions specifically make provision for the access of to electronically stored information, to information that are held in computer systems as in the inspection process, because in the case of majority of cases, institutions capture that sort of information electronically these days, and the inspector would have to extract that information from a computer system. The idea is not for the inspector to inspect the integrity of the computer systems itself, it's to require the institution to provide it with the information that is stored in the computer records, computerized records, as part of the inspection process, and this is not done under the authority of a warrant. As far as access to electronically stored information under warrant is concerned, I think that is part of a broader principle of criminal procedure and the Electronic Communications Act. I think, if I'm speaking under correction, expanded the power to use search and seizure warrants to access electronically held information. But that is part of a bigger, broader environment of criminal procedure law that governs the access to information that will be used proceedings of criminal nature. Then there were a couple of questions on the centre's plan to review or amend the schedules and whether certain institutions will be included in the institutions in the scope of the legislation as it is determined by Schedule 1. The review of the scope of the Act is certainly one of the issues that are under consideration by the centre at the moment. As I've said just now, we are also in the process of reviewing the broader framework of the legislation, the obligations it imposes on institutions, the scope of the legislation, and the framework of the institutions it provides for. So Schedule 1 will definitely be under review as part of that process. The review of Schedule 1 hasn't commenced yet, but there are certain international best practices that indicate in particular types of industries, etc., that need to be included. And our own experience will highlight other industries that also would need to be included because they either provide access to the financial system or they are particularly vulnerable to money laundering activity. And those were basically the two criteria that were used initially when Schedule 1 was crafted, when the legislation went through Parliament initially. Which is why at that point of view, or at that stage, institutions like debt collectors were not included because they were not at that point considered to be vulnerable from a money laundering point of view, or they were not considered as institutions that are intermediaries to provide easy access to the financial system, provide financial services. That situation might have changed now, and those would be types of institutions that would come in under consideration for inclusion in Schedule 1. Particularly as far as the Land Bank is concerned, I have already been in discussions with the Land Bank on this for some time, and the issue here is to particularly understand the business of the Land Bank and the risks that the nature of its business would pose from a money laundering point of view. And that would inform the decision as to whether the Land Bank should be included in Schedule 1 or not. But that is a process that hasn't run its course yet, so I cannot speculate at this stage on whether they will become an accountable institution or not. Certainly the process is in place to consider that. And I think the view from the Land Bank side, if I interpret the initial comments correctly, is that they would not object to becoming an accountable institution. There was a question asked about the role of the Minister of Finance and his powers in terms of the administration of this Act. Now, the Minister is politically accountable for the implementation of this legislation. And in the broader government framework, the Minister is politically accountable for the anti-money laundering effort and the implementation of the framework in our domestic context, which is why he also has the authority in terms of this legislation to take the administrative steps that are necessary to establish the institutions that function in this framework, such as the centre, appointed director of the centre, the Counter-Money Laundering Advisory Council, appointing the chair and its members, and also the appeal board. Those are all the structures that would also be politically accountable to the minister in terms of this legislation for which he is responsible, which is why he's the authority that is, or the entity that vests with this authority in this legislation. And I think, as Joanna pointed out earlier, the same issue of trust and implementation that applies in any legislation where any minister is made politically accountable for the administration of a particular piece of legislation would also apply in this case. I think there are checks and balances built into the system. If a system doesn't deliver results or delivers perverse results, that will be highlighted very quickly, especially in a system like this which cuts across authorities and departments and institutions, where law enforcement authorities, supervisors, all have to interact in the same context, and where there's international scrutiny and exposure as well on a system. I think there's very little room for abuse of these powers that are provided for in the legislation at the political level. Internet banking, I think the issue around this is not an issue that's necessarily under discussion at the point of in terms of this, these amendments, but it relates to the provisions in the Principal Act on client identification and how those would apply in a non-face-to-face environment where a person interacts through the medium of the internet with a financial institution like a bank, for instance. That does pose its own risks as far as identification, verification, the true identity of the client is concerned, and that is something which we will be researching further and taking into consideration as we look at those obligations that apply as far as identification of clients are concerned. But certainly there is also a measure of trust and discretion that needs to be afforded to the institutions that apply these to make sure that would mean that they would have the responsibility to make sure that they take the appropriate steps to identify the client through whichever medium the client communicates with the institution, and that they would be held accountable for how they exercise that discretion. issue of registration and of accountable institutions, specifically as it applies to attorneys. The approach in the legislation, or in the implementation of the legislation, has been to apply the obligations that refer to attorneys, or as they would apply to attorneys, in the context of attorneys' firms. There's an exemption that was passed by the Minister at the outset when these provisions came into place, where that says, for instance, the obligations to appoint a compliance officer and so on, can be performed on behalf of individual attorneys by a person in an attorney's firm, and that would suffice to meet the obligations of the legislation. And the same principle would also apply in respect of the registration. So we would not expect each and every individual attorney or each and every person that's admitted as an attorney to register with the centre, but where a firm of attorneys practice, the trust account is held in the name of the firm, then that firm would have to register and advise the centre of who their compliance officer would be that they've made responsible for the implementation of the obligations within that firm. And the same would apply to other accountable institutions where we've been dealing with the obligations or the implementation on the institution to institution basis. NGOs, again, it's an issue of the consideration of Schedule 1, the scope of the Act, that determines the breadth of this framework. Based, as I said, on the initial principle of providing access to the financial system or having displayed a particular vulnerability for money laundering purposes, at that point, NGOs were not identified as a category of institutions in a money laundering context. And at that point of view, zero financing was a part of the equation. At the moment, our intention is not to include NGOs or charitable or religious institutions as accountable institutions, to bring them into the framework of this legislation as it applies to financial institutions, for instance. Because the nature of how they interact with society is completely different to an institution that deals with clients provides a conduit to the financial system in that context. There may be a different way of dealing with NGOs or charitable organizations, but it doesn't fit the same recipe that applies to financial institutions or financial intermediaries, for instance. So therefore, we're not at this point considering including them as accountable institutions in Schedule 1. I think there's a broader issue that sits, a debate that sits outside of the context of money laundering and the FIC Act on the oversight function over non-profit organizations. And there are, for instance, authorities involved like the Revenue Service that perform a certain function there, the Department of Social Development that perform a certain function there. But the overall policy is one of enabling rather than restricting and providing an environment for NGOs to deliver the necessary services that they do, rather than restricting the ability of NGOs to perform those functions. And as I say, it's in that context that the debate of oversight over NGOs needs to be had. It will not be something that can be dealt with, particularly within the scope of the FIC Act. The decision on the amount in the administrative penalties, I think the decision of to a particular amount in respect of any penalty is to some extent an arbitrary one, but what informs the decision is the likely nature of the consequences of breaches at the serious end of the scale, that's why this is the maximum penalty, and the implications are for an institution to take an informed decision whether and weigh up their risks. And you might find, especially in the context of administrative penalties, that a rogue institution would say, well, it's worth paying a fine of 10 million rand if it will save me 100 million on implementing a new computer system. Therefore, I'll accept the risk and I'll pay the penalty. Now, that is a worst-case scenario, but I think that's why that's the maximum end of the spectrum. And there are certain factors also prescribed to supervisory bodies that they must then take into account when they decide appropriate penalty on a particular, in response to a particular set of circumstances. there was a question asked about the comments that have been received in the process of consultation, or over the course of the consultation process, and the extent to which those comments have been taken into consideration. I think the first point to make is that the bill that's currently before this committee looks vastly different from the bill that was published for consultation initially, and that is largely as a result of changes made to the initial proposed draft in response to comments that were received then. Subsequently, there have been a number of discussions and consultations, especially with supervisory bodies, which led to further amendments and changes being made to the draft up until the point that Cabinet approved the tabling of the bill that's now before the committee. So there has been a constant process of adaptation and changes made in response to consultations. But of course, we haven't necessarily agreed with all comments that were made in this process, and where we didn't agree, we obviously didn't make the changes to reflect a particular comment. What we'll propose to do is when we give our feedback next week, subsequent to the public hearings, we will make it clear where we have considered a particular issue but not agreed with it and therefore not adapted the bill in response to a certain change, and where we actually have made changes in it, where we agree with the comments that have been made. The issue of training, I'll come to that issue just now when I talk about the implementation process, because that is certainly part of the planning phase of the preparation phase within the FIC.
You should proceed into the implementation section. Mr. Mother?
Chairperson, I just wanted to ask one question, and from all the feedback, it's quite evident that you need very special skilled persons doing this job, especially because of this global interaction and compliance with that. How do you make sure that you've got, that there's enough skilled people, and do you have enough skilled people, and how do people get trained to do this very specialized work?
Yeah, proceed, but also just deal with the implementation, because that's part of the implementation.
Thank you, Chair. That is certainly part of what I want to cover as part of the implementation process. The remark on implementation is how the FIC sees, the finger sees the possible implementation of this act from the FIC's perspective. And it's not to say that all supervisors will follow the same process. We would not presume to be speaking for other supervisors on how they would plan to implement, but certainly everybody needs to go through this process of planning and preparing for the implementation of this act, which will take some time and needs to be done on an incremental basis. I think the first point to make is that supervisors that do not already have the capacity to carry out inspections would need to create that capacity. And for the centre, that would mean appointing an inspector. It would mean exactly the questions that were asked just now on training and preparation of skilled staff, finding and recruiting staff that have the ability to carry out the function of inspecting institutions. The types of inspections that we are likely to deal with are would be routine inspections, where you would on a regular basis inspect a certain type of institution to confirm that the risk rating of accorded to that institution is still valid, that circumstances within the institution hasn't changed, that they still maintain correct internal systems and procedures. And those would probably be inspections that you would carry out on a certain cycle, once every 5 years or something to that effect. There would also be thematic inspections, where you actually want to inspect implementation of a particular issue. For instance, let's say an amendment takes place that requires a new obligations to be met by institutions. You could then carry out the themed inspections that focuses only on that one aspect 6 months or a year down the line to monitor the implementation and progress. A case in point was the recent inspections, or not so recent anymore, the inspections that the Registrar Bank carried out in respect of identifying existing clients of that in terms of this act. I think that's a good example of a themed inspection. Then there would also be inspections in respect of specific concerns, where either through information that's available to the centre or through previous inspections, it would become apparent that within a particular industry or within a particular institution, there's a specific compliance concern. And you want to inspect and ascertain whether there in fact is a problem and then what the extent of the problem might be. The routine and thematic inspections would be undertaken from in the centre in terms of an inspection plan that would be drawn up, determining the frequency of inspections and the timing of inspections, and would also be an interactive process with the institutions that are to be inspected to set up the time frames and the appointments and the expectations of the inspections. All these inspections would have to be undertaken in terms of inspection manuals, which are currently in the process of being drawn up within the centre that will lay down the step-wise process of inspections, the rules that inspectors would have to follow, clearly describing their legal authority so that they do not overstep their authority during inspections. And these would have to cover all three scenarios of routine inspection, field inspections, and specific inspection. As I say, this is currently work in progress within the centre, and in making sure that the information is provided for in these inspection manuals and the systems to draw up inspection plans, we are also interacting a lot with other supervisory bodies and even supervisory bodies from foreign jurisdictions who have gone through this implementation process previously. As far as inspections are concerned, the other requirements would be to budget for the inspection process, to recruit appropriate staff, and I think that this comment was made just now is very valid. This is a very small pool of skilled people that to recruit from, which would mean that we would have to recruit people and expose them to training and experience either through internship or exchange programs with other supervisors to broaden skills. But there are ways of doing just that and giving the inspectorate staff the necessary exposure so that they can carry out their functions appropriately. In addition, the steps that need to be taken in preparation for this inspection process would be to implement within the centre the necessary systems to capture and analyse information that will inform decisions as to when and how or how regularly inspections should take place. And this is tied to the directives that we were talking about earlier that would require certain information to be provided on a regular basis, either quarterly or annually, from institutions that can be analysed and certain baselines set so that you can determine a risk-based approach as to how and when institutions should be inspected. And all of this needs to take place, as we said earlier, in the context of interaction with the supervisory bodies to make sure that there's a consistency of approach between the centre and supervisory bodies and that there's a clear understanding as to whose responsibility inspection of a particular industry would be. I think the point that we would want to make about inspections in the FIC is that we would be creating a separate, a particular inspectorate division in the FIC, which would mean this would be provided for in the FIC's budget, in its strategic planning, in its reported on in its annual reports, in a transparent fashion as the actions of the FIC currently. And I think particularly the issue that came up in previous questions and comments on the cost of inspections, from the FIC's point of view, this is something the FIC envisages bearing on its own budget as a general rule. We do not envisage passing on the cost of inspections to the institutions inspected unless there is a very particular set of circumstances that requires a particular type of inspection, but certainly not routine inspections or thematic inspections or even the majority of specific inspections where there's a particular concern that needs to be inspected. Which is why we need to go through this planning and budgeting process. The plan from the FRC's point of view is to start off relatively small. An indicative number, for instance, would be to employ an initial complement of 3 staff members as inspectors, bearing in mind that the FRC would take responsibility for a particular or a relatively limited number of institutions or industries in comparison with other supervisory bodies, such as the FSB, for instance. And that this capacity would then increase over a certain period. At this stage, plan to reach a first level of capacity for the inspectorate within 5 years. In addition to the recruitment of new staff, we also plan to draw on at least the part-time availability of existing staff. And we have been in the process over the last few years of exposing our staff to inspections and the inspection environment, where we've actually sent staff members out on joint inspections with other supervisory bodies, so that they can experience the nature of inspections and understand the context in which these inspections take place, the processes, procedures, and so on that are followed. And that experience can also be drawn on, at least on a part-time basis, to assist the full-time inspector. Timeframe for the census preparation concerns, there are a number of processes that are already underway, such as the preparation of the inspection manuals and so forth. The budgeting, for instance, is also already underway, but it's scoping and envisaging the cost of employing inspectors and the cost of actually carrying out inspections, such as travel and subsistence costs, etc. The formal recruitment of the full-time inspector is envisaged to commence during May next year. And recruitment processes are never an exact science to predict, but in our experience, it would take a minimum of 3 months to bring people on board, have them appointed, fully functional within the FRC, and then be able to expose them to training, exchange programs, whatever the case may be, the formal training on inspection skills that they would require. We believe that the shortest possible time frame that we would be able to commence with or be ready to commence with inspections by August 2009. And I think that the question was asked, does that imply then that we envisage that is the time frame for the legislation to take effect? And from our point of view, that is correct, that is the time frame we would be looking at more or less to giving effect to the legislation after or these amendments after they are passed by Parliament. We do not envisage a situation where the legislation is passed and put into force immediately, because just like the centre, other supervisors would also need this period of time to at least get into their budget cycles and strategic planning cycles for the implementation of these functions. The next set of issues that we would have to prepare for is the implementation of the administrative sanctions, which is a separate function that needs to be performed from the implementation of the inspection provision. In this regard, the centre needs to put in place the internal systems and policy processes that will determine how information is received and assessed to inform decisions on the appropriate administrative sanctions. And this would include the capacity to vet an inspection process, make sure that the inspection process itself was done within the prescriptions of the legislation, that the inspection process isn't under challenge, but also that the information uncovered by the assessment process has integrity and can be usefully applied to base a decision on the appropriate sanction. So this is a separate step from the inspection process in the way that we envisage the implementation. We do not envisage a situation where the inspector actually also decides on the sanction. We believe that there needs to be a check in the process built in, which we would have to prepare for. In addition, we would then have to prepare the guidelines for the processing of that information, the guidelines that start from the provisions of the amendment bill on how the decision should be taken, what factors should inform the decision on an appropriate administrative sanction. And then there should also be a process of monitoring the effectiveness of appropriate sanctions after they've been implemented, especially where sanctions are aimed at remedial action that needs to be followed up. So those processes all have to be designed and implemented within the FIC. At the moment, the FIC is focused currently on the preparation for the inspection process, the manuals, etc. So this isn't work that's currently underway yet, but certainly that we will have to commence at least at the start of the next financial year. Then the third set of issues that we need to prepare for from the FIC's point of view is the support to the appeal board. Since the FIC will be hosting the infrastructure for the appeal board, it would mean budgeting for that function again and recruiting the appropriate staff or allocating the appropriate responsibilities to existing staff. We foresee this function to be largely an administrative support function to enable the appeal board to carry out their function. An additional area which we expect we might be involved in is to provide advice into the process of identifying possible candidates for the board. This isn't something that has been raised with the centre yet, but we expect the centre and other supervisory bodies might be part of the consultation process to advise the minister on an appropriate pool of, or at least an appropriate process to identify possible members for the review board. In addition, the implementation process would also involve the process of the appointment or processing the appointments made by the minister. This is something which could either be done by the centre or by the National Treasury. But that process needs to be dealt with through publication, formal appointment letters, etc. of the members. From the FIC's point of view, we would certainly need to determine an internal structure for the secretariat to the appeal board and the position within the broader FIC structure to allocate where that secretariat will sit and to which part of the current FIC structure the secretariat will be accountable. Those are both strategic planning issues that the FIC needs to undertake within the coming cycle of strategic planning that's due to commence very shortly. The time frame that we are envisaging here is the infrastructure planning, the budgeting that is already currently underway, the structural or organizational issues will be underway very shortly during, as I said, the coming strategic planning cycle. Then again, there's the recruitment process we envisage starting in May, and the training for the staff, which would not be the same level of training you would expect, for instance, for inspectors, to start in June when the recruited staff members are on board. This is assuming that we need to recruit additional staff to perform this function, which is something that the centre needs to, a decision that the centre is due to finalise very shortly. And then we envisage the appeal board also being ready to start functioning, or at least the secretariat to the appeal board ready to from August next year to start functioning. In addition to these processes that are aimed at giving effect to the specific provisions of this amendment bill, there are also other processes that schedule of supervisory bodies. Currently, the schedule of supervisory bodies contains references to outdated legislation. So there are technical changes that need to be made to update that. There are also bodies that are included in that schedule that are not necessarily appropriate because they don't necessarily perform a supervisory function. But there are other bodies that do perform supervisory functions that are currently not included in the schedule. On the one hand, updating the schedule, but also correcting the composition of the list of supervisory bodies is also a process that is currently underway. And we envisage this process to be completed before the legislation takes effect if we are looking at a commencement date of August next year. Examples of the issues that we are considering, for instance, in relation to the schedule include the question whether the company's registration office should be included as a supervisor or not. This is a discussion that we need to have or in the process of having with the company's registration office. But it is dependent on the type of functions and the functions that they perform, whether those functions are in fact of a supervisory nature or not, whether it's useful for them to have the inspection powers or not, whether they would ever be able to perform that. There are also references, for instance, in the current schedule to the Reserve Bank, the Reserve Bank as a supervisor, but that is not necessarily entirely accurate. We are currently in the process of discussing with the Reserve Bank whether certain departments of the Reserve Bank should be referred to as supervisors instead of the whole organization, which could make more sense, especially in relation to the implementation of these amendments. Those processes all need to be done on a consultative basis, and that consultation process is currently underway, also with bodies that are not currently on the included in the schedule, such as provincial licensing authorities in the gambling industry, for instance, or and provincial law societies. In addition to this, the process of finalizing the memoranda of understanding, or at least finalizing the agreement between the centre and supervisors to allocate the different responsibilities and formal arrangements for the implementation of these amendments is already underway and needs to continue and needs to be clarified and finalised before the legislation actually takes effect. So that is a process which we are envisaging bringing to. It will never be a final conclusion because that process will always be a dynamic one, but at least to reach a certain level of certainty and agreement with all the supervisory bodies involved before the legislation takes effect. And then there's a broader issue of the network with other authorities outside of the supervisory environment. We talked about the involvement of law enforcement agencies, for instance, for investigative authorities, and their interaction with supervisors, which is not has not traditionally been a relationship that is well established. I think that is something that needs to be focused on and receive some attention in the period leading up to the commencement of this legislation, and at least appointing certain people that are responsible for maintaining contact or sharing information. We refer to it as gateways for sharing information, but it's not necessarily the correct term, but at least having a network of people that can interact and communicate with each other in the implementation process. So those are the views of the centre on how this act may be given effect to, and I think the time frame is probably the major issue that needs to be considered. So from the centre's point of view, the shortest possible time frame would be between now and August next year. That might not necessarily be the case for other supervisors, but that is the view that, of how the centre would implement the legislation.
Any additions? Are there any questions in relation to the implementation of the amendment? Mr. Marais.
Thank you, Chair. Just very briefly, and that is just maybe in confirmation or in terms of my question earlier, the international compliance of the training. And
of interest to learn, even in a draft manner, as to what kind of experiential or paper, academic type of requirements was FEIC envisaging these inspectors having. Was it going to be someone with a more financial background, someone with a more legal background, you know, what is it exactly that they would be looking for? Because these inspectors seem to be would have to have some kind of knowledge of auditing to some degree, some kind of background on the legal side, and then also a clear understanding of the financial dynamics. And that's really a very tall order, but can we just try to hear what FEIC itself is envisaging as a short-term and maybe long-term process?
Mr. Sim?
Thank you, Chair. Just on implementation again, because it just confirmed that we're looking at August 2009 for the legislation. I know it's convenient for the colleagues to meet with us and for us to deal with this as quickly as possible, but given the wide variety of submissions and then looking at the proposed program that we've just received, where it is proposed, and I'm using that advisedly, that we consider the formal bill on next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, should we not allow, as a committee, more time for interaction between those parties that have given submissions and the FIC and National Treasury to iron out all the technical and other amendments before we formally consider the legislation, given that it's only required next year? Thanks.
Okay, I think Mr. Singh's question is directed at the committee and not at National Treasury. We'll deal with that. Is there another one?
Thanks, Chairperson. If you check on the presentation of APSANE, they have got a bolded paragraph.
Let's not go to the submissions yet, lest we are seen as...
No, I wanted them to respond to this.
No, they'll respond to it after APSANE's presentation has come before the committee.
Okay.
I know members have read that, and the temptation to begin to deal with them I'm also tempted, but I don't want us to go there now. Let's allow time for the submissions to be dealt with at the same time.
I'll rephrase the question, not touch on the actual presentation. I want to check on the issue. I think somebody raised the question with regards to who's supervising the supervisor. I heard somebody kicking about. I think it's a critical question. But as a parliamentarian, because like this area is very technical, and I would expect that you would like us to play a particular role in terms of playing the oversight role. How do you envisage that to happen? Because like, I think it's going to be difficult. Like, I've been trying to visualize myself doing oversight on this type of legislation and other things without really tailing behind what we see in the media. What is the oversight that we can do and that would be effective to make sure that we are able to at least assist where there are blockages in terms of implementation. Thank you.
Okay, let's take responses. And I think Ms. Mokoto's question, like Mr. Singh's question, is also for the committee to respond to. We must attempt them to take to us how they want us to oversee them. They'll be quite happy to tell us how they want us to do it. They have a very quick answer to that one. Okay.
Just a small one, Chair. I'm just concerned that most of the time frames that have been mentioned here are from May next year, 2009. I mean, you're talking about a year. Why such a long period? Because some of us have got huge concern that, you know, we'd want to see this legislation taking effect.
I'll try to answer the question on the training. There are currently supervisory bodies that are already carrying out inspections as a regular feature of their business, and that would be one source of training for newly recruited inspectors in the FIT's case. There are also international counterpart supervisory bodies that are well versed in the carrying out of inspections in the money laundering compliance area. So that would be another possible source of training. But in the end, it is the responsibility of each institution, the FIC and other supervisors, to make sure that the training is vetted, is up to the standards that they envisage the inspections taking place. I think one of the most crucial aspects of training is actually learning by doing, which would mean internship or exchange programs. I think this is one of the most valuable sources of training. Accompanying what we have found in the FIT's experience is allowing our staff to accompany existing supervisors and observing how they carry out their functions has been made hugely beneficial. Understanding the concept of inspection and what it involves. We would be hesitant to recruit from existing supervisors, recruit inspectors from existing supervisors, which not to say that we would never do that, but we would, as a rule, attempt not to poach people from existing supervisors as a source of recruitment, but rather recruit people that can be exposed to existing inspection processes in supervisory bodies. And I think that deals with or brings me to the next question on the numbers of inspectors in existing supervisory bodies. Now, I don't have the exact figures on the capacity in other supervisors as far as inspections are concerned, but we know from our experience, for instance, that the FSB has a well-established inspectorate division that only does inspections, and it's headed by a relatively senior manager in the FSB. In the bank supervision department, they also have internal capacity to do inspections, which the registrar has made use of in certain a part of the systematic inspections I referred to earlier. We also know from experience other supervisory bodies, such as the National Gambling Board has an inspectorate, the State Agency Affairs Board has an inspection capacity, and they're looking at expanding that also in the foreseeable future. So the capacity is there within inspections, within supervisory bodies to carry out inspections. I think what needs to be considered is the expansion of the knowledge of those inspectors to understand the compliance issues as far as money laundering is concerned, the expectations of what institutions are required to do to identify clients or to report information and so forth. So that can become an additional skill for existing inspectors. The type of qualifications the FIC is looking at, we have been mostly focusing on a combination of legal and auditing skills or qualifications in the recruitment processes so far, where we've earmarked or identified certain people that might move into a possible inspection role. And from our experience with interaction with other supervisory bodies, that is probably the easiest qualification or easiest criteria to identify. But you find that the skill to question assess and interrogate information is not necessarily something that goes hand in hand with a particular qualification. So we're not limiting ourselves to recruiting people from a specific academic qualification or a specific academic background. But what we have found that this combination of legal and auditing qualifications provides a useful point of departure. On the question of the time frame, I know the Chair has said that this is not necessarily an issue that they need a response from us, but our view on this, for what it's worth, is that we need the legal certainty to start the planning processes and preparation processes. We need to know at the FIC, and I assume for other supervisors as well, what is the end objective that we need to work towards. And as long as the legislation isn't in place, we actually have nothing to start that process on. If we, for that isn't there, we cannot actually justify incurring the additional expenses or motivating the expansion of our budget. That has been the same stumbling block in the case of other supervisory bodies as well. So we would not advise holding back on the passing of the legislation so that the preparation process can take place. I think it's maybe somewhat of a chicken and egg situation, but from our point of view, we need to have that line drawn so that we have the certainty to base our future planning and implementation processes on. I think that the last question I want to deal with is the question again of oversight of supervision. And again, I know the Chair said that there's not necessarily an issue that we need to respond to, but the FIC is accountable to this committee. We need to submit our reports and our annual reports and present our activities to this committee as part of the oversight function over the FIC. And certainly when this is part of the FIC's functions, this will be something that one of the issues that we need to be reporting on and reflecting. And there will be a measure of control and oversight built into that. And I think that same principle would apply to oversight over other supervisors where they are accountable and building in the necessary transparency for them to be reporting on how they perform their functions, including this function of money laundering compliance. But that would be the only way that we believe there could be true transparency and oversight over how this function is actually executed. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, do you mind if I add something to that? There are two issues. I don't want that we leave the committee with the impression that there is an overwhelming capacity within the existing supervisors, because that's not the case. I think that they all will struggle, and they'll certainly all come and appeal for increases to budgets and access to funding and so on. So we understand that. But in the course of their existing work, they understand the inspection process, and that's a very valuable resource that we need to build on. But secondly, Honourable Phelps' question is a very important one, and I think I raised this in our annual report discussion towards the end of last year, that what we are seeing is that the compliance function across the market is one which is growing rapidly, and there's simply not enough skills around in the country at the moment. Yes, we've got auditing, accounting skills, financial skills, legal skills, etc., but they're not necessarily operating within a compliance framework. And that's certainly of concern to us, and I think one of the challenges that we face as an organization is we bring people on board who then get schooled and trained in the compliance components, including inspection. They also then become poachable, vulnerable to institutions and to remove them from us. So that there's a huge expense that goes in, and the challenge is how do we retain those staff. We have, as a centre, started engaging with tertiary institutions, early days, but to see whether those institutions can't begin to put compliance as a course within the university that students could follow. So you're not simply doing law or studying law or accounts. You could also be doing it in relation to compliance-related matters. So that's an area that we want to explore and push. We think that it will have benefit to the financial system as a whole, not just in terms of AML-CSD. Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Thank you. That brings us to the end of this briefing. I would like to take this opportunity to thank both National Treasury and the Financial Intelligence Center for this briefing. And from tomorrow, then, we will be listening to the oral submission. We also have written submissions that are before us as we speak. And that's why I was restraining the Honourable member of this committee serves in such for lobby groups, he serves in his personal capacity or, you know, authorized by his or her political party to do that. And I would want to urge members to desist from such, because when we then come to this forum, when you served in another forum that is a lobby group, and when you come to this forum, we then you then have a difficulty, you know, playing your oversight role and your independent role as a legislator. But as I'm saying, unfortunately, we are also members of our political parties, and from time to time, our political parties put us in such difficult situations where we have to represent them, but at the same time, come back here and exercise our duties. But we've had a very wonderful tradition in this part, for the committee, that we are able to stay above those things in order to be able to discharge our responsibilities. We also thank members of the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence that joined us today. I'm told that they are not able to join us tomorrow, but I would want to urge you that if there is anything that you feel would need our attention before we finalize this legislation, please feel free to do that so that we can deliberate on it and make sure that we have a product that is both desirable and also serves the purpose it is intended for. Well, thank you very much. So tomorrow we meet at 9:30 in the same venue, which will be here, to take submissions, the written submissions. We normally end our meetings just a few minutes before 1 o'clock so that members can look after their own stomachs. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you very much.